Dr. Hoiberg, are you there?
I'm right here.
There you are. How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine. I'm fine. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing okay. We got we told everybody about you already.
Okay.
But it's
just to let you know that this is past my bedtime, so if I drop off for some reason, you know, just yell at me or
join all our other listeners tonight. So let me give a little backstory. I'm an old, you know, I covered the Bulls for a couple years, and I like writing about basketball. And Iowan Magazine, we did a story on Fred, your son, as coach of the Bulls. And
right.
You and I talked back when they got off to such a bad start. But what was interesting in talking to Fred, he was very humble about it. He talked a little bit about you. But then as I researched your career in studying rural society, it was so interesting to me, and it was so timely, and some of the changes we're seeing. And I went out and bought this book, Persistence and Change in Rural Communities. I found it on eBay or something. But talk about it. Talk about what your background is. I already told the listeners when we were looking for it. You know, talk about your history and your father. I think it's just so fascinating. Listeners should hear that first person from you.
Well, you know, I'm a second generation rural sociologist. My dad was a rural sociologist, and he specialized in community development and worked in extension through the University of Nebraska, the Land Grant University of Nebraska, and was very much oriented towards practical application of sociological concepts to rural communities and rural community change. And so I guess I was pretty strongly influenced by that, because that's what I ended up becoming myself, as a matter of fact, a second generation sociologist. Interestingly enough, I think my uncle, my dad's brother, was also a sociologist, and he worked for the Rural Electrification Administration, the REA, back when they were electrifying rural areas back in the late 1930s. And so he was also very much involved in the sociological analysis of rural communities, and was, you know, very instrumental in one of what I consider to be the most significant changes in rural America, and that was getting electricity out into the hinterland. I had a bit of a maverick streak in me, because I decided that I was interested in sociology, but I was going to do something other than, you know, the direction that my dad took. And so I was much more oriented towards urban sociology, but with an emphasis on community, because I had an interest in community as well. And so when I got my PhD and started looking for jobs, Iowa State came on the horizon, and our department there was very heavily oriented towards rural sociology. And so kind of by fiat, I actually kind of morphed into a rural sociologist, a bit of a carbon copy of my dad. And so came to Iowa State in 1974 and have been here ever since.
Yeah, tell me about your father. You went as a young man, young kid. I mean, you went to Germany and Turkey. Talk about that chapter,
right.
Of your early life.
Yeah. My dad was hired I guess I could say hired into what they called the Civilian Corps after World War II. And it was kind of a parallel organization to the Army, only it didn't deal with, you know, warfare and keeping peace and that kind of stuff. It was much more oriented towards Reconstruction, especially after World War II. So my dad went to Germany, actually before I was born, and lived in Berlin, and then sent for us. This was back in 1944, sent for us, and I spent my first few years, I think my first 2.5 or 3 years, living in Berlin, Germany, of which I remember very little, obviously. But he was very much involved in working with churches. He worked with the World Council of Churches, and worked with churches in Germany during the Reconstruction, you know, helping congregations kind of cope with the Holocaust and, you know, and the various different kinds of things that went on during World War II. And so he was very much oriented towards trying to strengthen the base of the institutions and particularly the church in Berlin during that time. This was, interestingly enough, it was during the Berlin airlift when you know, there was a barrier for the Allies getting into Berlin, and so they had to bring in all of their provisions and everything in the through the air. And so we were there during that very historic time. And as I mentioned, of course, I was too young to remember too much of that. But my dad was very much kind of oriented to the international dimension. And so when I was in seventh grade, he got another position, this time working in Turkey, in Ankara, Turkey, helping to set up a land-grant university in eastern Turkey. And so, once again, I had an opportunity to live overseas for about 3 years during that stint. And, of course, I remembered and still remember a lot more about that particular time in my life. But I was so lucky because, you know, not a lot of kids my age back in the 50s and early 60s were, you know, had the kind of opportunity to sample the international dimension as much as I did. And so I always felt very privileged because of that. So those were, you know, those were a couple of things.
And your wife is a teacher? Was a teacher?
She is a teacher, yeah. And her two sisters were teachers as well. And her dad was the coach at the University of Nebraska, the basketball coach at the University of Nebraska. And so, you know, Fred got all of his basketball acumen from that side of the family.
I mentioned him, Jerry Bush, right?
Yeah, Jerry Bush, right, right. Used to call him the Coliseum Bear. He was a bigger-than-life kind of person. but he played professional basketball and then went to coach at the University of Toledo, and then from Toledo went to the University of Nebraska, where he ended his career. And so he, you know, very, very instrumental, I think, in terms of kind of instilling in our kids a love of sports.
And, you have three boys, right? Give us their names again, Steve, Fred, and Andrew.
Steve, Fred, and Andrew, right. Steve works for Siemens Corporation and lives in Omaha, Nebraska. Andrew works for Calcium Products, which is an ag input firm. He got his PhD here at Iowa State University and works for a company called Calcium Products. And then Fred, the middle son, lives in Chicago and is having a lot of fun this year.
Yeah. So. Well, the reason I asked that and to talk about all three sons is the background of the parents here, you as a sociologist and your wife as an educator, what type of skill sets does that bring into, as they were growing up, how did it, you know, well, Fred, everybody knows Fred here in Chicago, how does that help him as a leader and as a communicator?
Well, I think that they were probably, as was I, and as I think most of us, were pretty heavily influenced by our parents.
Right.
And so, you know, it wasn't really too great a shock that I ended up in academia, because that's kind of what I was exposed to as a kid. And first of all, the competitiveness that not only Fred but my other boys also have was kind of a natural byproduct of my wife's father, their grandfather, because he was a very competitive type person, and they all became very competitive in various different kinds of ways. But I think that competitive kind of zeal has served them well through the years. And, you know, when you and I talked a little bit for your magazine article, you know, we always tried our best to make sure that competitiveness was channeled in a productive kind of direction. And so, you know, Fred keeps pretty cool on the sidelines, even though inside he's he's churning, you know, a lot of the time. But I think that competitiveness was certainly developed through contact, and then my wife obviously is very competitive as well. But the educational part of things, you know, we always insisted that education came first, and you know, we all recognize the importance of it, and we all recognize that, you know, even if one of them went into professional athletics, that's not necessarily a lifetime guarantee. So we tried to instill in them the importance of education.
Can you hang with us for, because I want to talk about Irwin, then we'll let you go. Can you just hang on for a little bit after the news? And I mean, you know.
You bet.
Okay, so thank you so much, Dr. Hoiberg, for finding us. And we'll be back with more of Dr. Eric Hoiberg and WGN Nocturnal Journal. Very good. Julian Hager, that's our next guest coming up in a little bit from Door County, Washington Island. And I wanted to keep Dr. Hoiberg. Dr. Hoiberg, you still there?
I'm still here.
Wow, thanks for joining us again. And I didn't want to let you go without talking about Irwin, Iowa. This is one of the main reasons I wanted you to come on the show, is talk about your studies there. I've got the book in front of me. It was believed to be a typical example of a Corn Belt community. I told the listeners before what it was like there in 1940.
Right.
But you and I talked before about just the changing face of agriculture with automation, with global competition. So talk about what you did in Irwin, and then real briefly, what's going on in the rural communities of Iowa today?
Sure. The study was actually a restudy, as you probably have indicated to your listeners, of original group of studies back in 1940. A group of rural sociologists went out to study these very dissimilar kinds of rural communities. I think a lot of times people, when they say rural community, they kind of paint it with a broad brush and think that they're all pretty much the same. The fact of the matter is that there are very systematic and substantial kinds of differences, even among small communities like that. And I think that the original authors and investigators went out to kind of especially look at the state of the rural community coming out of the Depression years, because the feeling was that the Depression years had a fairly significant impact on the structure of rural communities, and so they wanted to kind of see what was happening and what the impact of that economic and social kind of disaster, in a sense, had on these local communities. And so we went back in the 1990s, approximately 50 years later, to study these same six communities. And Irwin, as you mentioned, was chosen because it was a typical Corn Belt community, what many people, I think of as a rural community when they hear that term. And these communities were originally chosen on the basis of a kind of a continuum of stability, all the way from the least stable, which was a community down in Kansas, a little town called Sublette, to the most stable of the communities, and that was a community in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, the area where the Amish, the Old Order Amish, were very prevalent. And Irwin was seen as kind of right in the middle of that stability continuum. It had experienced significant kinds of changes, to be sure, And they were about to experience more significant changes because of the onset of mechanization and farming and agriculture.
You went there.
Which had a profound effect.
You went there over 8 years. I mean, I read in the book over back and forth for over 8 years.
No, not really. It wasn't probably quite 8 years. I mean, I go out there periodically, and so, you know, I still maintain some ties out there, but. But the primary work that I did was done on a sabbatical. I had a sabbatical for 6 months when I was teaching at Iowa State.
That's where I was going with that. So, yeah, what changes have you seen? I mean, you know, and I think when you and I talked before, I talked about, I mean, it's been all over the national news. I mean, the New York Times did a thing on Storm Lake, and you know,
right.
The New Yorker did Orange County, Iowa, the Dutch community there and stuff. But what changes do you see? You touched on technology. What about immigration? What changes do you see in rural communities in Iowa now?
Well, you know, the population base of Irwin and the population base of many communities and small communities in Iowa, there has been a lot of pressure put on those communities, and one of them has to do with the kind of demographics. Because the demographics and the changing demographics have really had a tremendous impact. On not only on the local agricultural scene, but also the local rural communities. And basically, I think that, interestingly enough, I heard the other day, which I think is a very interesting thing, and I haven't had time to track it down yet, but I heard a statistic the other day that said that for the first time in a long time, there were actually a very significant number of younger people returning to agriculture.
I've heard that too, actually.
And actually returning to farming. You know, and I was in the College of Agriculture for about 11 or 12 years as an associate dean. And one of the things that I noticed during that period from 1974, when I originally got there, to when I left finally in about 2005 or so, was that people, students were still finding agriculture. They were, you know, they were coming into agriculture, but it was a much different kind of agriculture, you know, than the one that they had been accustomed to, you know, one that is very science-based and one that is oriented towards business and the business model and the profitability and mechanization and all of these other kinds of forces that are taking place. So the kind of agriculture that they were entering oftentimes was quite different than the one that, you know, the previous generations had been involved in. And one of the biggest kinds of factors is that, you know, there's a constant, a relatively constant number of acres out there. Mm-hmm. But perhaps the biggest change that took place in agriculture, over the last 50 or 60 years has been the growing size of the Iowa farm, but also the lessening numbers. You know, there are fewer and fewer people out there on the land. And because of mechanization primarily, people are able to farm a great deal more land and many more acres than they had been in the past. So the number of acres and the inputs to agriculture and the mechanization and all this kind of thing, I mean, there was still a great demand for people to get into agriculture, but not necessarily farming. And so, you know, typically when we looked at the student population of the College of Agriculture, they weren't going back into farming. I mean, some of them were, a few of them were. But they were pursuing other kinds of alternatives in agriculture. And so it's really interesting to me now that this trend, which I don't even know if I can call it the trend yet or not, but this recent finding that young people are kind of rediscovering farming in greater numbers now is, I think, a very interesting kind of dynamic, and I'm anxious to kind of see if I can find out a little bit more about that.
Fred told me he never took one of your classes, but
well. The only time that I remember was one time Fred was sick, and Karen, my wife, was teaching, and I had to teach it at Iowa State, so I brought him down to one of my classes, and so I had him sit in the back row back there while I talked about something, and afterwards he came up to me and he says, "Dad," he says, "what do you actually do for a living?" You know, he saw me up there talking and pontificating and, wondered what the heck is going on. So, but that was the only time it was in any of my classes.
But he said, you know, and then he followed that up by saying he's just so proud of how many lives you've touched throughout the state and in terms of your outreach and in terms of your teaching, you know. I mean, you've really made an impact, you know.
It's when I look back on my career, I feel so fortunate, you know, because I was in a position to be able to have an impact on people. And I was very conscious of that, you know, and so I took it as a real responsibility. And you know, we had wonderful students at Iowa State University, and the people in Iowa are also wonderful, wonderful folks. And so it's been a fantastic place for us to be here and to raise a family.
Before we let you go, I mean, I was doing some research, and you said there were three points that would assure you that a student would be successful if they had leadership in high school, strong communication skills. But I want to go on number three here and kind of how this maybe affected you in your own life. Curiosity and exploration. I mean, that's just so important to be curious about everything.
Well,
throughout your whole life.
I think it's the key, as a matter of fact. You know, I mean, what I consider to be the most fundamental of all educational experience is asking questions. And you know, if you have curiosity and if you have an interest, and if you've had an opportunity to explore that through reading, particularly, we always emphasize for our kids the importance of reading and that's a way to develop and foster curiosity. Then they know the kinds of questions to ask, and they can hopefully, you know, go a ways towards trying to provide some answers to those questions. And so that's been a particularly important part of the way that my wife Karen and I have brought up our kids.
You're a fascinating guy. Do you ever come here to go to a Bulls game?
Oh yeah, we come quite often, in fact.
Well, you have to come to the studio and hang out with us before.
I'd love to see you.
Yeah,
I'd love to see you. The home of Orion Samuelson. Right?
That's right. That's why we wanted to have you. You're an avid listener. Well, thanks so much, Dr. Hoiberg. I hope to talk to you again.
Dave, it's been a pleasure.
And go Bulls. Okay.
Yep. All righty.
Okay. We'll be back, and we're going to pay tribute to the 4th annual Washington Island Fishbowl Festival after this on WGN.